Let me, so thank you. We'll go on to the last speaker, by no means the least. Dr. Narish Singh will address the findings and implications of the final report of the Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor, which was hosted by the United Nations Development Programme and co-chaired by Madeleine Albright and Hernando de Soto. It will focus on the intersection of human rights and markets and outline an agenda for legal empowerment of the poor. Dr. Singh is currently acting vice president at the Canadian International Development Agency's Canadian Partnership Branch. He has served as principal advisor of poverty and sustainable livelihoods in the Bureau for Development Policy of the United Nations Development Program from 1996 to 2001. He was also the director of the Poverty and Empowerment Program at the International Institute for Sustainable Development in Winnipeg, Manitoba. All these titles for these organizations, it's no wonder they go to initials. Anyway, Mr. Singh has worked internationally in more than 40 countries and has served as an advisor to several organizations, including the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, the Pan American Health Organization, Washington, D.C., the Foundation of International Environmental Law and Development, the U.K. He's also adjunct professor at Boston's University School of Public Health and visiting scholar at Harvard University's Global Equity Initiative. Dr. Singh.
Thank you very much, Ruth, and let me say a warm thank you to the Canadian School of the Public Service and to McGill University for asking me to join this panel. Today has turned out to be a very beautiful day for me. First of all, the weather is great. But secondly, I had the great fortune of listening to a former Prime Minister of Canada and a former President of the United States in the same day. And here, the essential argument that they both have made today is that the energy for change now and for the foreseeable future will come from non-state actors. That's a great paradox for me. I work for the state. So I'm going to have a little challenge in how I share my thoughts with you today. But let me say, first of all, that what I'm going to share with you are ideas that I strongly, personally believe in. And most of these ideas are shared by the Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor, of which I was fortunate to have been the executive director, the commission to which Ruth referred, and which had six former presidents and prime ministers as members, six former finance ministers of members as members, and several academics. So hopefully these ideas have some credibility and would provide this platform for action, because these were all policymakers, people who and politicians, people who are always in need of urgent action. Let me start by saying that this big, complicated thing is not really necessary. I want to talk about empowerment, but I want to point out that empowerment really is a nonsense word. Somehow I have ended up working for this under this title, empowerment, on more than one occasion. It's a nonsense word because empowerment seems as a transitive idea to sort of suggest that those who have power will give power to those who do not have willingly. A little reflection will show you that that has never happened in the history of the world. Power has always had to be taken. Nobody has ever given power those who had power to those who did not have willingly. If we do not find a way in which this power is going to be shared, people are going to take power. And they might do so in the traditional way, which has been violent, unless we find other ways. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of those other ways, as other colleagues have done. So let me start then by talking on what is the problem I want to address. I want to address a problem which might surprise you. 4 billion people on this planet are not able to use the law to either create new economic opportunity or to protect the assets on which they make their living. That includes the poorest of the poor, but also another 1.4 billion, the 2.6, who live on less than $2 a day, plus another 1.4 who cannot use the law. They are like hidden in plain view. It's a very intriguing situation on the planet. Let me give you some examples. 1 million Peruvians do not have legal identity. 4 million Venezuelans don't exist legally. And half of all the children born in sub-Saharan Africa are not registered at birth. If you don't have legal identity, you cannot have the rights of a citizenship, no matter how constructed. Let me talk a little bit about another area that I will discuss a little bit more later, property rights. People live on land and they live in houses and little shacks, whatever they have. They don't have any ownership, any legal ownership of those assets. They don't have any property rights, in other words. We can estimate what Hernando de Soto calls the dead capital that exists in these countries. Dead because they cannot participate effectively in market transactions since there is no legal backing. It's exactly what caused, in a way, the economic crisis we are in. After the derivatives were tranched and retranched, until there was no paperwork connecting this vast amount of wealth with the physical assets on the planet, we lost control. That's what the basis of the economic crisis is. That has been a permanent crisis of the developing world in which we have, for example, $5.8 billion U.S. dollars worth of debt assets in Haiti, a small country, moving on to nearly $312 billion U.S. dollars in debt assets in Mexico, $248 billion in Egypt. And these numbers have been thoroughly tested by the economists in these countries. And I have pretty a fair confidence as far as economists go, you know. But let me move to another issue that I will deal with. And that is the issue of labor rights for those people who live in the informal sector. 92% of the people of India make their living in the informal sector, outside of the ambit of the law. Globally, the number is 80 to 90%. There is no social security and no minimum wage for maids and taxi drivers and hairdressers, people who work and make their living in the informal sector. And that's where the majority of the developing world's population live. So we got a little challenge. Let's talk about the access to justice and rule of law if we're going to talk about empowerment. Here are some stats quickly. In India, 20 million legal cases are pending. It takes about 20 years for civil cases to reach the courts. There is just about 11 judges for every million people, and the numbers are similar in other countries of differing sizes. And let me one last point, because I'm going to talk about business law as well. Why should it take 500 days? You have to go through 315 laws, and it costs about the equivalent of 6 months' wages to register a baker shop in Cairo. Similar situation in many other countries in the world. The law is not working for the majority of the world's people. Well, when we were doing this work, I thought I better come and talk to the Canadian Bar Association. After all, I'm Canadian, I'm sitting in New York, I'm traveling around the world dealing with all these big challenging issues. So I came to the Canadian Bar Association. They organized a nice meeting, brought in a lot of people from around Canada. We had a nice conversation. I was stunned to find out that the law in Canada does not work for the poor people of this country either. That I still cannot believe, but the experts tell me that that is true. And the lawyers here might either confirm or disagree with that, and we can talk about that. But that's the problem. Those are the problems I want to talk about. So what do we do about it? Well, first of all, I'm going to be talking about legal empowerment. Crazy as that concept is, empowerment. And it's not the same as legal reform. Because empowerment needs several of the things that Phil put on the table. People have to have voice. They have to have identity. They have to be able to form organizations. And then they have to seek representation. Those are the initial conditions. And none of those are necessary for legal reform. But then we have to do some reforms of the institutions that constrain the people from moving forward. Poor people see the law not as an enabler, believe it or not, but as a punitive, constraining system. They're afraid of the law. They should love the law to be able to make a living. The reason this country is so wealthy and the United States is so wealthy is essentially because we have property rights systems. So, if we were to have those initial conditions, I will now talk about what kinds of changes might we make to the law in four areas. In the areas, well, first of all, broadly speaking, of access to justice and the rule of law, to property rights, to labor rights, and to business rights. And why those four? Simply because that's the way we make our living. Property rights are the assets. I mean, if you don't have any assets, you know, you are not able to have a sustainable livelihood. And people either work for themselves or they work for someone else. When you work for yourself, you call it labor. Sorry, you call it a business. When you work for someone else, you call it labor. And that's why we have those two. And if the overall system is not functional, none of these will work. And that's why we chose those four sort of categories. And the whole outcome that we seek here is, one, that people's assets can be protected, and two, they can have new economic opportunity. So what can we change? Here are some basic things. And I'm just going to give you one example and go through this. The report is on the web, and I'm mortally scared of this orange color thing on the right here. So let me move quickly. One of the things we found in this overall access to justice and rule of law is the confusion between what the law, whether the law works for people and what it says in the Constitution. Everywhere I went and I spoke to Supreme Court justices and I spoke to chief justices of the world and so on, and they say, they will start by saying, the Constitution of this country guarantees, and it goes on and on. You know, we are all equal before the eyes of the law. We all know how far from the truth that is in the operation of the law and where it leads us. And it's not true that all we need to do is to enforce the law. That is very important. But that's not all that we need to do. There are laws that just work against poor people. There's a whole book written by Naresh Saxena. I remember that because that's my first name as well. N.C. Saxena wrote a book in India called The Anti-Poor Laws of India. Laws which were once intended had good intentions, but things have changed, and they now work against the poor. If we have time at the end, when we have the discussion, I'll give you concrete examples of how these work. So you will have that PowerPoint, and we can talk a lot about informal justice systems. And this is not about formalizing the informal. I think the world misread the situation for a long time. This is about building on the strengths of the informal until you move to a situation which works for all. Because if you were to attempt to formalize the informal sector of the world, you will create even more poverty overnight. Big issue. Let me talk a little bit about property rights in one, maybe one recommendation. What we argued for in the report of the commission was that we needed a functional property rights system in which the poor can get out of poverty. And by that we mean four things, very simply. A property rights system has to have a set of laws through which people relate to the assets that they own, or they live on, or they use. It need not be individual property rights, it could be collective rights. Eleanor Ostrom has just won the Nobel Prize in economics, which for me is a really huge surprise. There are other Nobel Prize surprises, as you know. But she has been working on collective property rights for the longest while in the natural resource field. Never thought that she would have won the Nobel Prize. Similarly, when Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize, we were all stunned. He happens to be one of my mentors and worked on the issue of human development and transformed the concept where economic growth is not the end. Human development is the end. The economy should be a means to an end. People should be the end. The world reversed that for a very long time, where human capital is merely an injection into the economic system. Lots of things need to be changed. So the property rights system has to have a set of laws, but it must also have a market which works. And in that market, we have to have positive discrimination. Unless you have progressive social and economic policies, the poor are likely to lose out, giving them title in a market in which they do not have enough information is going to make them even lose that which they have. So it's about making property rights systems which work. We talk a little bit about labor issue. The main issue, I think, here is how do you formulate a package of labor rights for people living in the informal sector in a way in which you don't kill micro-enterprises? If you attempt to put the full ILO conventions into force overnight, the chances are the micro and small businesses are likely to go out of business. You can't afford that. You will create more poverty. Now, the UN, for which I've had the honor and sometimes the displeasure of serving in, normally because of the nation states that comprise the UN and the negotiations that we would have, they will argue you must have all the rights at the same time. Well, I truly believe in the universality of the Human Rights Declaration. But human rights-based development is a different thing. And that's where you have to do it, depending on the context in which you're in. So we've argued for a package, a small package of rights, and then a gradual increase in those rights. Let me move quickly to the area of business rights. Microfinance has done a lot of good for the world. And we saw a picture of a dear friend and Nobel Prize winner, Mohamed Yunus. Great work. But microfinance has a few limitations, like everything else, including this agenda that I'm talking about. One of those limitations is that microfinance tends to help people to get out of poverty, but keep them just above the poverty line. Very few people are able to go way beyond the poverty line through microfinance. Not only that, I have never met someone who was the recipient of microfinance that became wealthy. But I've met many providers of microfinance that did become wealthy. There was a good reason for that. The interest rates on microfinance, the lowest interest rates is about 35%. And it's not unusual to have 100, 150%. These days, by special interventions of states, the rates have come down to a low of 15% in some cases. It's very expensive to be poor. We would go crazy if we had 8 or 9% on mortgage rates, right? Because we are accustomed now to 2% or 3 or whatever it is these days. But the poor pay a very different. And there is good reason for that in the market economics. And the reason is, of course, if you don't have any collateral, your risk is very high, and therefore your interest rates are high. A lot has to be done to go beyond microfinance. And we have outlined a number of other legal business instruments that can help people to go beyond that. What about a limited liability corporation concept for the poor? Why is it that we have bankruptcy protection but they don't? So if their little business go broke, they sometimes have to even trade their families. That's how you get bonded labor. Your kids have to be bonded to work for the rest of your lives, the rest of your family for that matter. It's not the only reason, but it's a common reason. And so we have made a whole range of recommendations on how we think these business regulations can change so that others can participate, going way beyond the base of the pyramid arguments of Prahalad and others, and hopefully outlining. But let me move to some action quickly. There is a concrete way in how we might start, and I know Phil will like this, and hopefully McGill will form a great partnership with some NGOs and do what universities do well, and partner with what NGOs do well, and so we can move to a different way of partnering in this country and lead the way, perhaps, for the rest of the world. We might have to start with the poor themselves, as Phil argued, and others, and that they might be waste pickers or street vendors, or domestic workers or house-based producers. You know, when we talk about the poor and just use the word poor, it's so abstract. You don't get a reality of who you're dealing with. But a lot of these people have been forming organizations around the world and are ready to work, civil society organizations. And Canadian NGOs must be looking to work with these organizations as well. If they can bring some resources, some skills, some partnering, maybe they can't. I don't know. But then we have that yellow column, and maybe that's where we can help. Because if we are the elite and we are the non-poor, we have some work to do. Because unless we open up the space, we who hold the power, empowerment or self-empowerment, as I prefer to say, will not happen. And that's why you need that yellow bunch of people with money, knowledge, and training to work with those who are already trying to help themselves. And that's just some examples from urban areas. The same will be true in rural areas. Here the groups are different. Now we are talking of farmers and fishermen and farm laborers and so on. You begin working with those groups, you help them to form groups where they don't exist, and then you do the brokering to get people to begin to take action. But power is a difficult thing. The empowerment is not an easy exercise. It's not a technocratic exercise. It's a serious social sort of movement. People get killed in that process, as we all know. If you think of the leaders of empowerment of the world, you think of Gandhi, and you think of Martin Luther King, and a whole range of others. They are the real guys who led self-empowerment processes, and many others. So we have to understand the power structure of countries. Is power concentrated in the center? I did tell you that I'm not talking about the Canadian government here, right? I'm talking about the Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor. But unless you understand the structure of power in that country, you're probably not going to get very far. And that's a one big issue. We all know one size does not fit all. You know, I must say that after all these years of studying and reading about all the economic theories, I have not been able to find an economist or group of economists who have not been able to explain the past. They are brilliant at explaining the past, but have never been able to say, what are the recommendations that will make a country grow? And it happened. In fact, most of the time the World Bank has made recommendations of what countries should do, the opposite happened. And Danny Roderick has been writing at Harvard on a lot of this, the evidence we can find. There are a range of actors. The state has a very important role. Both our honorable former prime minister as well as former president Bill Clinton said the energy was in with the people, with social movements. Not going to happen unless we get enlightened leadership within the state as well. Not in my lifetime. And that has to happen as well. We have a bunch of recommendations. It was good that people like Madeleine Albright and Larry Summers and all these former presidents were in this commission, because the state leadership is so important. But we have a range of action that is required from non-state actors. I've just written a paper on, and you know, we can do that later on. All right, so my orange card is here. Before I get a yellow one, let's finish this. That paper is on the role of civil society actors in changing power relations. Because the typical role of NGOs have been to do some other very important work, but I think not the most important work, which is about changing power relations. That, for me, is at the heart of the poverty problem. We will continue to provide health care, water, and other services to the poor of the world until the cows come home. CEDA will have another 40 years of doing this, and we will still be where we are. That's my own estimation. Unless the power relations change. Of course, donors might have a role, not a big one. So let me conclude. The nature of empowerment and legal reform are very different, as I mentioned at the beginning. Empowerment is a totally different ballgame. It is about social organization, it's about voice, it's about identity, and it is about how do you change power relations. Now, I will leave a little thought here with you, and that is, if we continue to believe that power is a zero-sum game, that for the poor to gain power, the elite must lose power, we are likely to lose. But I believe we can reconceptualize power as a positive-sum game, in which when the poor do better, the elite will do better as well. It might look like self-evident, but the leaders of the world, political leaders of the world, don't believe that very easily. But we have some work to do. The second point is that I've outlined a range of human rights, business rights, labor rights, property rights, in a functional access to justice and rule of law. These can work with markets. I have never seen poverty reduced anywhere where there were no markets. I do not believe that the socialist welfare state will reduce poverty. Furthermore, and I put this one because you might have some fun, this is university, all the data that I can find suggest that wealth creation has always preceded stable democracies. And there's a direct correlation between per capita income and the stability of a democracy. It is not democracy which comes before wealth creation. So I argue that markets and human rights must work together. Let me just leave it by saying that I believe if we draw on Canada's assets and Canada's strengths, which the Honorable Joe Clark, the Right Honorable Joe Clark referred to, hopefully our country can be a leader in the self-empowerment process of the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Naresh. I mean, 2 points. Obviously, Naresh made a compelling argument why we need to change the power relations and the fact that markets and human rights go together.